Great to have you with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Hi, Larry Mueller here. Happy to have you along today on this Wednesday. You know, every Wednesday we try to focus on the environment, and today I think we have a really special opportunity. A couple of guests for you. Dayton Duncan, writer, producer of the documentary The National Parks, America's Best Idea. And he's written and produced several other of Ken Burns' documentaries. He's in Wisconsin to deliver the first annual Jordahl Public Lands Lecture. And Dayton, it's a real pleasure to have you with us today.
Well, it's my pleasure to be here.
Appreciate it very much. With us as well, Steve Bourne, Emeritus Professor of Urban and Regional Planning and Environmental Studies. Been a guest many times on this program. And Steve, always great to have you join us.
Thanks, Larry. Good to be here.
Let's talk about public lands for a minute. You, Steve, you're a professor of urban and regional planning and environmental studies. I'm guessing public land management is something you've thought a lot about. And first, maybe what falls under the heading of public lands?
Well, public lands are those lands that are owned by the state. In some cases, they could be construed as lands that are open to the public because the state or the federal government or local governments have conservation easements that provide access and so forth to those lands. And in Wisconsin, we've got about a little bit less than 6 million acres of public lands. And of those public lands, about 2.6 million acres are owned by counties in their forest and park systems. The Forest Service and DNR and the Commissioner of Public Lands Office have the balance of those lands about equally, about 1.5 million acres apiece. So that's the public land mix in Wisconsin.
And what are the challenges, maybe, Steve, of protecting those lands and making sure that they get that they're safe and that they get used?
Well, I'm sure Dayton will talk about this because the same themes that are here true and here in Wisconsin also resonate across the country. One of the problems we've got is loving them to death. Natural areas, special park places are an attraction for all kinds of people, and there's been increasing usage of those. And at some point, you've got that inherent conflict between taking care of that ecosystem and the things that establish these parks and special places, and then the pressure on them. There's a huge issue in Wisconsin related to public lands generally, and it has to do with privatization of hunting and fishing and access for the public, traditions that are taken for granted here and elsewhere, but are increasingly becoming stressors. There's always issues about the scale of management. We protect a place, a river system, a wetland, but we don't get enough of the territory included, enough of the issues to really provide the kind of protection and management we need. And finally, there's always a challenge with regard to funding, bonding issues, tax revenue streams, and just challenges and scrutiny with regard to what the payoff is for the investment in public lands.
Yeah. So those are our kind of issues here in Wisconsin, and I imagine, Dayton, you probably found some of the same things. But let's start sort of at the beginning. How did your work on the National Parks, America's Best Idea, how did that come about?
Well, I have the best job in America. I work with my best friend, Ken Burns, the best filmmaker, a documentary filmmaker in the nation. The films that I write and produce are the ones that that I suggest. And so I suggested to him, we've done film on baseball and jazz, which are American inventions.
Yeah.
And the national parks are also an American invention, and they're connected inextricably, I think, with who we are as a people, with the Declaration of Independence. They are the Declaration of Independence, I would say, applied to the landscape, that our most magnificent and special places should not be the exclusive property of royalty or the rich, as they had been throughout all of time, until we, the nation founded on the notion of the Declaration of Independence, said, no, there's going to be some places here on this continent in our nation that are so special that we're going to preserve them for everybody and for all time. And it was, well, it was also a great excuse for me to get to go to all 58 national parks. I'll be honest about that. But we are, what we were interested in was following it as an idea, as an American invention, and to watch it evolve over time. And in doing so, learn more about who we are as Americans. It's a uniquely American idea, as uniquely American as the Declaration of Independence, and I would say just as radical, that like the ideas expressed in the Declaration of Independence have now spread across the whole globe. There are now national parks in not every single nation, but almost every nation around the globe. And it all comes from this idea that we had here, that, you know, the first expression of it, I'm not going to say the idea began, but the first expression of it was during the midst of the Civil War in 1864, when Congress set aside the beautiful Yosemite Valley and Mariposa Grove of sequoia trees in California, but entrusted it to the state of California on the deal that they would keep it special, inalienable was the term at the time, meaning it couldn't be privatized for all time. And that started this ball rolling that ended up with national parks, that ended up with national forests, that became national monuments. Here, you know, Mr. Jerdahl himself was involved in a new expression of that in the 1960s with national lakeshores and wild and scenic rivers and national recreation areas. There was a whole burst in the 1960s, 100 years after the first expression of the idea. So what national parks is what we focused on in our film, but that's just part of this larger system that says these great places need to belong to everyone. They don't belong to one person. And if you let it belong to one person, they're going to do what human beings are going to do, and that's just going to be to close it off and not let anybody else in it. And it's for our enjoyment of our citizens. But it's not just the citizens that are alive today. They are there for the enjoyment of citizens who haven't yet been born yet. And so that there is this tension of between, as Steve was saying, between, you know, overuse and preservation. But at the same time, that's a really good democratic tension.
Yeah.
Democratic with a small d. Meaning that that's what we do. We talk about these things. We work it out. But we have to remember that it's not just the here and now. That's not what parks and public lands are about. They're about, as John Muir would say, a good practical, another Wisconsin guy with a Scottish accent, a good practical sort of immortality.
Just an afterthought, Larry. You know, this great American innovation that Dayton is talking about has been contested at every step of the way. Even in the creation of the first national park, Yellowstone, there was a California congressman, as I recall, who couldn't understand why private ownership and use of the Yellowstone area wouldn't work out just fine over time, and it extends all the way forward to today, where amidst the political bluster, you see bills being introduced in states to have eminent domain over the public lands and unwild the wild, unroaded areas, and it goes on and on. So this is always a battleground.
Talking with a couple of great guys today, Steve Moran, Emeritus Professor of Urban and Regional Planning, and Dayton Duncan, writer and producer of the documentary The National Parks, America's Best Idea, and other Ken Burns documentaries as well. He's in Wisconsin to deliver the first annual Jerdahl Public Lands Lecture. Are you aware of wetlands in your area? Do you know how to... are you aware of the parks in your area? Do you know how to protect them? What's your favorite way to enjoy our beautiful areas in our national parks? Have you visited those parks? Love to hear from you at 1-800-642-1234. It's 1-800-642-1234. You can email us at talk@wpr.org or go to my Facebook page. You can post there at The Larry Mueller Show. We would love to hear from you. So, you know, today, Dave, when we hear national parks, we think of a whole system of areas, mainly out west. Was that the idea in the early years? Or?
Well, you know, like all American ideas, it grew and evolved without a real plan. It evolved. It evolved the way so many things do. I mean, when they set aside Yosemite and gave it to the state of California, they weren't thinking, and this is a historic moment that will now, you know, reverberate through the generations and end up with a system of national parks. Even when they did 8 years later in 1872, they set aside Yellowstone. They modeled it after Yosemite, but Wyoming was a territory and not a state, so they couldn't give it to a state. So they basically said, well, we'll just make it a national park. And it's almost by happenstance, we became the first nation in the world to have a national park. As things moved along, John Muir was incredibly important in this evolution. They discovered that in places like Yellowstone and Yosemite, these big national treasures, it was better to have it to be a national park rather than under the care of the state. It just kept some of the special interests and other things a little more at arm's length. Not that they weren't involved in some national parks as well. And then it grew and it became much more of a system. And then, other people got involved and you had national monuments and other things like that. But the system, it took a while before they had a whole number of parks, about 10 or 15, before there was a National Park Service. The Army would be in charge of the parks. Then there was a National Park Service, and this charismatic leader of it, Stephen Mather, in the 1920s, said, this is a system, and we need to think of it as a system. We need to promote it as a system. I think one of the things that we learned when we were doing our film about the national parks is that people, all the things that people think about national parks, except that they're special, is sort of backwards. They assume that they've always been there. They assume, and some of the resistance to public lands these days is that it's this big imposition from the federal government, when in fact they have not always been there. They are always the result of dedicated people on the ground at that place, or groups of people who love that place so much that they'll do anything. They'll work hard, dedicate themselves for 5, 10, 20 years so that the government finally will set it aside for future generations, so that other people that these are, originators of it will never meet, will have the same chance that they had to see that place like they did and to fall in love with it like they did. So, and as Steve mentioned, every single park is the result of some local people getting involved, and it is always a battle. It is always a battle. John Muir said the battle of conservation will go on endlessly. He defined it in terms of good and evil, as a guy who memorized the Bible might. But he, it's never easy. The Grand Canyon, which I would posit is probably the most self-evident national park place on Earth, was first proposed in 1882 to be a national park, 10 years after Yellowstone. It would have been the world's second national park. Well, it was defeated because there were too many special interests and local people said, no, you're taking stuff away from us. This is a big intrusion of the federal government. So it didn't pass. 1883, same thing. 1885, same deal. John Muir kept advocating that it become a national park in 1902. Teddy Roosevelt, the most energetic president we've ever had and the greatest conservation president we've ever had, wanted it to be a national park, couldn't get Congress to go along with it. This thing called the Antiquities Act that he was given the exclusive power, presidents, to set aside things for historic and scientific value. It was originally intended to be, small cliff dwellings and like that. He said, well, the Grand Canyon is of scientific value, being the greatest eroded canyon on Earth, and therefore I hereby declare Grand Canyon National Monument, 840,000 acres. But it didn't become a national park until 1919. So you take that's a 37-year fight from 1882 to 1919 to make the Grand Canyon
a
national park.
Which you think would be just an automatic?
It should be a gimme putt. But that just to me is exhibit A of what you're always up against when you're trying to advocate for public lands. Yeah. That, again, a lot of people enjoy them, they take them for granted, but there are always interests that try to twist things and try to restrict it and try to prevent it from happening, or even to take it back out of public ownership and put it to some private use.
And Dayton's point about the battle being endless, as Muir and others noted, well illustrated in the Grand Canyon case, where uranium mining was being posited on the rim of the Grand Canyon as a sort of a compatible use where the smoke from major electric utility coal-burning plants wafted across and impaired the visibility in this great treasure. It is a daily battle to preserve these very, very special places and at least honor the original purposes for their establishment.
Dayton Duncan and Steve Bourne, our guests today as we talk about our national parks. I'm Larry Mueller. Judith Sears-Poisson, our producer on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Talking about America's natural areas today and our national parks with a couple of guests, Dayton Duncan, writer and producer of The National Parks, America's Best Idea, and other Ken Burns documentaries, and Steve Bourne, Emeritus Professor of Urban and Regional Planning and Environmental Studies at UW-Madison. Great to have them along. Certainly looking forward to hearing what you might have to say about your trips to national parks or your thoughts about our national lands. Jeff in Webb Lake called that number. By the way, it's 1-800-642-1234 if you want to join in. And Jeff, thank you for calling. What's on your mind?
Well, it's not about national parks. It's about something a little closer to home. Kind of a horror story. There's a little place in southern Douglas County. It's undeveloped in the sense that there's no houses on it. Just one of our little gem areas, you know. Townland, county land surrounding it. And, you know, you were talking about some of these lands possibly being taken away. Well, apparently it's happening there. This town, it's the township of Dairyland, basically gave this land for some ridiculous thing like two back-to-back 50-year leases for some ridiculous price of a dollar each or something to a private party that kind of tugged on heartstrings saying they were going to build a veterans retreat there on this public land. Well, you peel back the layers of the onion a little bit, you find out that nothing's going to be given to veterans there or anything. They've basically given these people a place to build a hotel. And
well, that's a,
you know, there's a group, yeah, there's a group of us who just can't imagine that could happen, but apparently it.
All right, that's an issue. Well, Steve, I'm going to turn to you first. Is it a story that you've heard before?
Sometimes. Dayton, having just flown in from Vermont, probably has echoes of similar stories from his neck of the woods. It's interesting how groups of local citizens have energized themselves, often through the land trust movement. Here in Wisconsin, we've got more than 50 land trust conservancies, and they've protected more than 200,000 acres of very special places to them at the local level. Oftentimes, they've taken contentious land parcels and been able to negotiate with the owners a deal that would protect these special places. That's something that the caller might want to look into, whether a local land trust might be able to facilitate something like that. I would note that the largest state land deal in recent years, the St. Croix Brule Legacy Forest acquisition, which was a conservation easement with a private timber company to protect 67,000 acres of land up in the Douglas County area and to provide access for hunters and fishers to that land and a more sustainable kind of forestry, is certainly a step in the right direction in how we leverage our stewardship funds to accomplish these ends. These battles always start local, as Dayton noted. Even big things in Wisconsin, like the Apostle Islands National Lakeshore, happened because guys like Bud Jordahl and Gaylord Nelson and Dave Obie and Martin Hansen sweated and fought over this for 30 years. So these are long-term battles, and you better gird your loins for a long trip.
Timo in Oregon, thank you for calling. Hi.
Hi. I appreciate that. That was President Roosevelt who took executive action to try to preserve the Grand Canyon. People will remember, too, that President Clinton, on his way out of office, simply declared a national monument for a large, beautiful, unique section of Utah. But aside from presidents, I would just like to get the guests' comments on this, that the presidents can declare an area. They're subject to political pressure. It can always be taken back. Real change seems to have to come from someone in the Congress. And we've been very lucky to have champions in Wisconsin like Henry Royce and Gaylord Nelson. It's funny that it just doesn't happen at more different places. Why is it coming from Wisconsin instead of the places where the most natural places for national parks seem to lie?
Well, I'm Tim, I'm originally from Iowa, so I'm not going to sit here and say it's because Wisconsin is so special. But you do. But you have had a long and proud, very proud history in Wisconsin of national leaders in terms of conservation and public lands, from John Muir to Aldo Leopold to Gaylord Nelson and Mr. Jordahl and others. And so whatever it is, in the water or in the air, you know, count yourself lucky. But you're right that presidents have this one little tool. It's the most important tool in of all the law, conservation laws, I think, because it does give presidents the authority to declare a part of the public domain, public land, a national monument if it fits certain criteria. And certain great presidents have used that. Besides Roosevelt at the Grand Canyon, as you mentioned, President Clinton at Grand Staircase Escalante and other places, Franklin Roosevelt saved the Grand Tetons using the Antiquities Act. Jimmy Carter put aside, using the Antiquities Act, enough land in Alaska that it doubled the amount of public land that had been protected. But to be permanently protected, or at least more permanently protected, Congress needs to act, because that's the way it is in a democracy. And what that means is you're thrown into that, you know, cauldron in which there are different points of view, there are different interests at stake, and it just takes is never easy. There are always going to be people who are just going to be against it for a variety of reasons.
You know, thanks again for calling, Tim. I appreciate it. We had a Facebook question from Jerry, wondering what your opinion, Dayton, is of public lands in the hands of the Democrats or public hands in the hands of the Republicans. The parties seem to have very different views of protecting our public lands. What are your thoughts in that area?
Well, it depends on the Republican and depends on the Democrat. I mean, mm-hmm. there have been bad ones and good ones on both parties. Teddy Roosevelt was a Republican. And as I said, without question, the greatest conservation president in American history. I mean, there have been some other good ones, too. Abraham Lincoln is the one who signed the act that got this all started in Yosemite, and Ulysses S. Grant signed the law, a Republican as well, creating the world's first national park in Yellowstone. I am a Democrat, so I need to, in truth and advertising here, full disclosure. And I think that there are factions of the modern-day Republican Party who, on the one hand, don't really I would like to say don't completely understand the value of public lands and how important they are to us as a nation and as a people, and sometimes are either for ideological reasons and sometimes bending to the will of people who have other ideas of what they'd like to do with mining or drilling or other things in lands that have become extreme. They want to take away the Antiquities Act from the President of the United States. And it came within a couple of votes in the last Congress of doing that. And that Antiquities Act has, you know, enabled presidents who can see over the next horizon.
Yeah.
And over these sometimes local interests to larger national interests that, you know, I could, if we had the time, I could walk you through all the great places in America that were first set aside by far-sighted presidents. They want to take that away, or they want to encroach on different national parks or national monuments. I think they're just dead wrong. But it relies on all of us as citizens. This is what, you know, this is a democracy, and this is the way it works. Those places belong to, you know, everyone who is hearing my voice is a part owner of Yellowstone National Park and Grand Canyon and the Apostle Islands and all these other places. And as a equal owner of that, you know, it'd be great if you go out and check your property every once in a while. Go and see how well it's being taken care of. And talk to the people who are your servants, your elected officials, if you think things need to be done. Those would be nice to do. You don't have to do that, and you're still an equal owner of it. all that is asked of you, the only sort of responsibility I think that you really have, is that you, as owner of that property, it's up to you to put it in your will so that your children mm-hmm. and their children and their children's children will also be equal owners of it. Because a place can be ruined and ruined forever, but if it's saved, it's never always saved. It always takes a new generation mm-hmm. of leaders and of activists and of just concerned citizens to keep these national treasures as they are, inalienable for all time.
Mm-hmm. I think just adding on to that, Larry, as the caller indicated, for those of us who love these special public places, the political season seems to produce some of the nuttiest conversation with regard to the public lands. I know during the Republican primaries, Rick Santorum vowed to sell off the public lands to the private sector, saying the federal government doesn't really care about these lands. And there were other statements to the same purpose. And yet, this is not a partisan issue, as Dayton notes. Here in Wisconsin, the conservation movement has been built by Republicans and Democrats alike. Warren Knowles, Gaylord Nelson, Tommy Thompson. There is no escaping the fact that these Republican and Democrat governors working with key local activists and progressive legislators have led to the tremendous treasure we have here in the public lands of Wisconsin.
Sally in Madison has a question or comment. Sally, hi, thank you for calling.
Yes, I'm calling about the new and only tribal national park we have in northern Wisconsin. We took the Wilderness Trail mm-hmm. into it a few weeks ago. I wondered if that's a trend now and how it came about.
Sally, I don't know all the specific details of that. I do know that there are a couple of other places out in the Badlands National Park. The Park Service is entering into a management agreement with the Ogallala Sioux Tribe for a certain portion of the Badlands mm-hmm. that is particularly sacred to them, that they are going to be they're going to, in essence, be put in charge of management. It will still be a national park. None of that changes, but they're trying to let the people who considered it home and sacred to them have a greater role in its management. One of my dearest friends of all time is a fellow by the name of Gerard Baker, who is a Mandan Hidatsa Indian mm-hmm. who just retired from a lifetime career in the Park Service, and he retired as the first Native American superintendent of Mount Rushmore. And if you know the history of Mount Rushmore, which is placed in the Black Hills, that was by a broken treaty taken away from the Lakotas, and the faces of four great presidents were carved on that in the stone there. It's one of the great sort of mixtures of American history. Each of those presidents are great presidents, but it's also on a place that, you know, that was taken from the tribe through a broken treaty. The fact that we got to the point, I think, where a Native American could be named as a superintendent of it and invite the tribes in to talk about that mm-hmm. background to it is a sign of maturity for us as a nation. If only a great nation is able to look at its history with clear eyes. So when the National Park Service included the Manzanar internment camp as a National Historic Site, where Japanese Americans were interned during World War II, when it could set aside Little Rock High School as a National Historic Site because of the battles there over segregation and certain other places that now talk about the slave quarters in certain National Historic Sites. I think all those things are a sign of maturity on our part, that we are looking at our history and saying part of what these public lands and parks and historic sites do is they teach us who we are. And part of who we are is not always events and issues in which we can proudly pat ourselves on the back. We need to have those things, certain places, set aside so we can remember the lesson that they teach us with the hope that we won't repeat those mistakes.
Yeah, I think for those of us who are listening who might be as old as perhaps Larry and I, Dayton's a youngster. If you've had the occasion over the years to visit the Battle of the Little Bighorn, and here you heard that story told from the point of view of the military and Custer years and years and years, but if you went back in the last several years, you would hear another perspective on the history of both the battle and what triggered it. And it's this rich perspective that brings in the Native Americans who were here long before the Europeans to share their history and perspectives and values that I think enriches all of us in valuing these special places.
Yeah,
that was my friend Gerard Baker, was the superintendent there for a while, too. He did that the same thing there. This is a story. It used to be called Custer National Battlefield, and we finally and wisely changed the name to be Little Bighorn National Battlefield. Yeah. Two American armies met there, right?
Yeah.
Both Americans. The Lakotas and others would say this was homeland defense on their part. but we need to, and it was a searing moment in American history. But we need to, in understanding the history, understand both American sides to the story. And as Steve said, when I was first, one of the first National Historic Sites I went to was that battle site, and I got very excited thinking that I'd picked up an arrowhead that I was pretty darn sure was probably crazy horses. And it wasn't until I got to be a father myself and took my kids to some places that it finally struck me, I bet my dad bought that arrowhead in the gift shop and dropped it when I wasn't looking. And sure enough, when I asked him about it, he did. But that was how it was portrayed back in the 50s and into this, and before and into the 60s. And now we've matured and we want to see America history whole. We can still be very proud of our nation and patriotic about it, but we ought to be more patriotic by being, by looking at our history and learning from it and seeing all the different complexities brought us to where we are.
I remember joking with one of the Lakotas out there at the Battle of the Little Bighorn, and he said to me, "You should pay a lot more attention to your immigration policy." We didn't.
Oh, Steve Warren and Dayton Duncan with us. Steve, Dayton's going to be speaking, and I really want to give people an opportunity to hear him speak as part of this first ever, I guess, isn't it, Jordahl, public presentation?
Exactly, Larry. When Bud died in the spring of 2010, a lot of friends and colleagues thought that an annual lecture on public lands issues would be a fitting way to honor this Wisconsin conservation icon and to create a continuing legacy through a yearly event that would honor his work as an educator, as a state policy leader, and in fact also as a hands-on farm owner and restoration land manager in Richland County, Wisconsin. And so we solicited funding. The Gaylord Nelson Institute took the lead, along with some nonprofits that Bud helped found, Gathering Waters and 1,000 Friends of Wisconsin, who have now been joined by the Wisconsin Academy of Science, Arts, and Letters. And there's a whole host of folks now who see the value in this. And we were so delighted to be able to bring Dayton Duncan here to campus for our inaugural lecture on that subject. The lecture is tonight at 7 o'clock. For those of you who might be in the Madison Arena, it's 7 p.m. at Mills Hall, which is in the Humanities Building, around Park and University Avenues, if you can wend your way through the traffic. Mm-hmm. It will be starting at 7 o'clock. And you can get more information about the lecture at the Nelson Institute's website, which is nelson.wisc.edu. So we think it's going to be an absolutely tremendous event. And while Dayton hasn't mentioned it, we've tricked him into signing some of his books from about 6:15 on. So if you have a copy of any of his books, I'm sure he'll be happy to sign it. And I think this lecture will be just a noble start.
Absolutely. And I'm looking at my Facebook page here at the Larry Mueller Show Facebook page. We have a link to the Wisconsin Wetland. I'm sorry, to the Nelson Institute. So if you want to get, if you want to take a look and get some more information on exactly where Dayton's going to be speaking, And the time is 7 o'clock, of course, and it's free and open to the public. Everybody's invited.
It's a public lecture. It should be free. You pay a little bit to get into the national parks. It's almost free.
It's almost free. Well, Dayton, as we're kind of winding up here, as we think about the parks, what's your vision of the future of our national parks?
I think the future of our national parks depends on whether we as a nation are capable of raising a new generation of conservation leaders. We are a nation that is increasingly diverse, increasingly urban, increasingly bound to couches and computers and television screens, and we have a higher and higher percentage of people who don't yet, and this is my hope, that don't yet feel what is actually true, which is they are owners of the most magnificent spots on earth. They belong to each of those, everybody, whether they have felt a connection to it or felt somewhat excluded from it. They belong, those places belong to everyone. And I think the great challenge for national parks, public lands, is convincing more and more people that these places do belong to you. Please come and visit them, because more than anything I can say, more than anything a Ken Burns film can show, being there is the best way to feel that connection to a place, to feel that connection to the people you're there with, and to feel the responsibility that you can have, that you want to make sure that this is there so that, you know, people 100 years from now can have that same emotion that's racing through your body if you're, say, standing at the rim of the Grand Canyon or enjoying the Apostle Islands. So I would say the future is that challenge.
Well, this has been an absolutely fascinating discussion, guys. I want to thank you so much. It's been a real pleasure, Dayton. I hope anytime you're in Wisconsin, you come by and say hello. We'll have you on.
Okay, thank you very much.
And Steve Bourne, he'll be back. I'm pretty sure of that.
Only if you invite me, Larry.
Okay. Dayton Duncan is the writer and producer of The National Parks, America's Best Idea, and other Ken Burns documentary here in Wisconsin to deliver the first annual Jordahl Public Lands Lecture. And you can find out, go to my Facebook page, you can find out more about it. He's speaking at 7 o'clock tonight at Mills Hall on the UW campus here in Madison. And I'm pretty sure as you listen to him speak, you're going to be in for a real treat if you can make it to his presentation tonight. Coming up, we're going to take a look at wetlands here in the state, our Wisconsin Wetlands Association, and also a little bit about wild rice restoration. That next year on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.